So just as yesterday, this is almost but not quite orthogonal to all the physics that you guys do. So, but I hope I can convince you that there's some interesting stuff here. You're going to need to wear three hats. One hat is manifestly biological. One hat is physics, and one hat is mathematics. And by mathematics here, you know, I don't mean Bessel functions. I mean hard math, in the sense of theorem proof, because there's some theorem proof stuff that I have that. It would be lovely if some of the hard mathematicians here, you know, could give me some advice on the mathematics part. Let me start with a question. Has anybody here seen, I know that Asher Shapiro, the late Asher Shapiro, a fluid dynamicist at MIT, made a movie, maybe Taylor made the movie, in the early 50s, of an annulus, and you put a little dot of ink in this annulus.
Taylor.
Was that Taylor? And you crank it up like this, you have 20 cranks, right? And you get this beautiful ring, annular ring. And then you crank it back, and it's a ring, and it's a ring, and it's a, and whoops, all of a sudden it's right back where it was, with a little bit of a smudge, right? And the idea there is that if boundary motion in fluid dynamics problem, if the boundary motions are themselves kinematically reversible, and you're in sufficiently low Reynolds number that everything is Stokesian, then the associated fluid velocity patterns are themselves also reversible. And so even though you can have something that's really stretched out like this, or in Taylor's drum, and or Shapiro's drum, maybe Taylor did it the first time, you know, it unwinds, it all comes back. So nothing happens with respect to transport of that ink dot. And what I'd like to try to convince you of is that that little extra smush that you get, and to my knowledge, I haven't seen that movie in a long, long time, but Taylor didn't talk about the amount of smearing that you got in that dot when it finally came back. His point was that it's almost entirely kinematically reversible. So if you think about how spread that dot is, that's actually an interesting question, because the smear of that dot is different if the dot was just sitting there, because diffusion happens over distances, it happens over gradients. If you spread things out like this, now there's more surface area for that gradient to manifest itself diffusively. And so the stretching itself can change, even though you unstretch it kinematically reversibly, when you unstretch it, you can still have an augmentation of the apparent diffusion. And this is the origin of a concept that we cooked up some time ago, which we called the stretch and fold theory of aerosol transport mixing in the lung. What we imagined was making phyllo dough instead of the annular ring that's going around like this. If you have something and you stretch it and you fold it, so I stretch and fold, stretch and fold, stretch and fold. Every time you stretch a fluid sheet, you're increasing, as I say, the surface area for diffusive transport. At the same time that you now take this doublet or triplet, stretch it out like this, now the lateral distance between the layers of the phyllo dough, or the Japanese sword that you're making, that lateral distance gets smaller. So the area is getting bigger, dx is getting smaller, all right? And if the net transport, goodness, these are all really tiny. I guess we have to do small physics here. So if the net transport is something like some kind of diffusivity times an area times, I'll actually write d rho dx. If the area is going up and dx is going down, because as I stretch this, this thing now becomes, I've now got twice the area. Here, area has gone up by 2, but dx or dz has gone down by 2, by whoops, by 2, up, yeah, times 2, down times 2. Now I've got a factor of 4, so that the effective diffusivity is going up. So that even though you might, you know, you look up in a book, and the book says that the diffusivity of aerosol something or other is thus and such a number, you say, well, okay, it's negligible. Well, maybe it's negligible and maybe not, depending upon the nature of this stretching and folding. So that's kind of the context that I want to try to put aerosol transport in the lung into. It's not dissimilar. I mean, since you guys have all seen the Taylor movie, I can just stop there. But sometimes I ask people if they like cinnamon sugar. I mean, it's a lovely little experiment. When you do, and we've all done it. You take a sugar bowl, and you know, you dump in a teaspoon of cinnamon. And you should do it and think about it when you do it next time. How many, you know, you go like this, and you just look, and you get this brown little swirly thing. You do it a second time, and now the swirl looks like this. You do it a third time, and it looks like this. You do it a fourth time, bang. It's uniformly brown. So it's as if there's this competition, I'll come back to this later, there's this competition between the length scale, there's some kind of, you know, typical characteristic lengths that as you're folding it, this would be number of folds, this length scale is coming down. This is exponentially, geometrically, this is an exponential decrease as things get folded. Each time you do it, it's a factor of 2. So this is, you know, this is 2 to the minus n, right? The diffusive length scales are growing like square root t or square root n. So that's something that looks like this. And so here's diffusion, which is proportional to square root n. This is very slow. It's almost the case that no matter how slow this is, the exponential is so fast that you say, okay, it's not going to work. You know, I'm not going to get a significant improvement in diffusion in 6 swirls of the spoon. Well, okay, give me 8 swirls of the spoon, and now you've gone from here to here, and now everything is mixed.
That's what you're saying. You're saying the cinnamon is diffusing? And the sugar, what are you talking about?
It's mixed.
I understand.
It's mixed. If you take a coarse grain view of the entropy of this, it's mixed. You can't, there's not a small enough spoon such that you could undo that. And in that sense, I mean, it's not diffusing in that sense, but that's not a good example for this argument of diffusion. This is an argument about real diffusion interacting with.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so forget the. Yeah. Right. Okay. Anyway, so this is the context. And why are we interested in this? Again, I don't have any, unfortunately, financial conflicts. So why are aerosols interesting biologically? So now we put the biology hat on. So pretty clearly, aerosolized things, sometimes they're bacteria, sometimes they're viruses, and we breathe these things. We also breathe particles, particulate aerosols, which include smoke, pollution, allergens, and things like that. And these are all things that are bad for us. We also breathe, and there's a lot of interest in the use of therapeutic aerosols, like, you know, metered dose inhalers for people with asthma, or not just the asthma market, but there's all kinds of interest in being able to really target where you want to put drugs. Do you want to put drugs in the central airways? Do you want to put drugs in the far peripheral airways? How do you do that? How do you, you know, do you want them to be big particles, small particles? You breathe fast, you breathe slow, you breathe shallow, you breathe deep. How do we target the deposition pattern of aerosols? So here's a piece of the physics of it. And the classical transport, and by classical I mean without this idea of stretching and folding. So classically, we say that transport is affected by the particle's inertia. You can have impaction, crossing, and streamlines. Impaction would, an example of that would be if you have a really dense, foggy smoke that's coming up off your barbecue, and you breathe this stuff and you think, well, maybe that's bad for me to breathe all that junk. And the answer is that's probably not very bad for you, because those particles are, you know, 40, 50 microns or higher. And particles that are 50 microns and above, or even 25 microns and larger, you breathe them in and you go like this and it goes to the back, it just keeps going bang, and it just impacts on the back of the throat. It doesn't go into the lung. And if it's on the back of your throat, next time you swallow, goes into the GI tract, and if it's not toxic, then it's just excreted. So breathing that stuff is not bad for you. Similarly, besides impaction on the back of the throat or in the nasal passages, there's streamline crossing as the gas streamlines are trying to go past, for example, the first bifurcation when the trachea comes down and the main stem bronchi come like this. The streamlines have to go like that. And if there's a sufficient amount of inertia in the particles cross streamlines. They don't follow the traffic pattern at this bifurcation, and they slam into the top of that bifurcation. And in fact, that's one of the sites where you actually see some of these particles deposit. So inertial crossing of streamlines is another one. Obviously, gravitational sedimentation is one. If the particles are big enough and weigh enough, then they just settle out. So you take a breath and hold your breath, and the stuff all settles down into the airways or the alveoli. And of course, Brownian diffusion. Now, the interesting part of the physics of this, so this is not the biology and it's not the mathematics. The interesting part of the physics is that there's a class of particles which we call fine or ultrafine. There's a slight difference of opinion about what constitutes fine versus ultrafine. Suffice it to say that what I'm talking about is anything between 10 nanometers and about 1 micron. Between 10, so about two orders of magnitude between 10 nanometers and a micron. But these particles, they're too small for either inertia, any kind of inertial effect, or even for gravitational sedimentation. But they're still sufficiently big that on any of the time scales of interest, like a breathing cycle, like 6 seconds, or a length scale, like 100 microns or 200 microns, which is the size of an alveolus, there's not enough time on that length scale for them to go very far by Brownian motion. Okay? So you would think that's great, because that means that these particles are going to follow streamlines, which they do, and they're not going to wiggle around very much by Brownian motion. And so if you breathe in, and if you breathe out in a kinematically reversible manner, just like Taylor's drum, you breathe them in, you breathe them out. No, there's no net transport, no deposition, no biological effect. Doesn't matter if they're toxic or not. Doesn't matter if they're bad viruses that are 50 nanometer size viruses. Doesn't matter. You breathe them in, you breathe them out. Okay. Except that that's not true. There are tons and tons of experiments that show that there is in fact significant mixing and deposition of these sized particles. And I'll come back to this later. It appears to be that the transport is much more sensitive to the volume that you breathe rather than to the flow, which has some implications about whether or the extent to which this is a dynamical phenomenon as opposed to one that is kinematic, where time is only functioning as a parameter rather than anything that is specific to dx/dt. So the question is, how or why can you get deposition in particles that are not supposed to deposit? And so at this point, I'm going to refer back to this idea of stretching and folding, because if there is kinematic irreversibility, then we have the potential that even though the Brownian diffusion may be very low, if by successively folding you've got a sufficiently big surface area and a sufficiently small lateral displacement of these phyllo dough layers one to another, then it might be that that is a mechanism that affects net transport. So what we did a bunch of experiments with rats, and we used polymerizable silicones of different colors that were essentially immiscible. So you take a rat, or an excised rat lung, and degas it, and then you fill it to its standard operating volume, this would be the functional residual capacity of the rat, with white silicone that's still liquid. Then you've got a ventilator, which is a syringe, filled with the same stuff that's blue. And again, the self-diffusion is sufficiently small that we can ignore it. And now you ventilate, just ventilate, so the lung goes like this, you come back out. And if you wanted to know what happens after one cycle, you would stop there, wait 30 minutes for it to polymerize, and then slice and dice. And what you would see, if it's kinematically reversible, what you would see is exactly what Taylor saw. Namely, that all that very complicated thing of that blue stuff going in and going through all these bifurcations and the bronchial tree and alveoli and all this kind of crazy stuff, when you come back out, if it's kinematically reversible, just like the dot, you know, on the annulus, it would all come back and you'd have a nice flat line of demarcation between the resident white silicone and the blue ventilating silicone. And you can tell by the way I'm advertising this that that's not what we found. So here's, I got a couple of pictures of what we found. So here's the bronchial tree, there's the trachea, main stem bronchus on the two sides, tertiary bronchi, all. So we sliced and diced, and here's what we found. It's after one cycle. Now, just as yesterday I said that there was a book answer for the way lung regrowth does not happen in adults, so too there's a book answer here, and that is that the ventilatory pattern in the lung is, we say, essentially reversible kinematically. And that was discovered by putting dots. You put dots on the pleural surface of an excised lung, and then you just watch. You just take these, you know, 3D photograph triangulation things. You just map the 3D position of the dots as you ventilate the lung. And you say, at the same volume, independent of the history of inflation versus deflation, if at the same volume those dots are in the same position, then it's kinematically reversible. And that's to a large extent true. That's not exactly true. But it may be the case, and we suspect that this is, in fact, what's happening, is that even a small departure from kinematic reversibility, I think, in fact, Taylor did this. I think in the second experiment, he actually put a hair, or it was something like a hair, and he put the dot, and he put a hair in the fluid somewhere, cranked it up, cranked it back, it didn't come back. So a small amount of irreversibility is sufficient to wreck that whole business of being able to come back to the original dot. Anyway, what you can see, of course, these are obviously transverse slices at various levels, but you can see the really unbelievable level of complexity. When we talk about the blue and the white not coming back to a nice simple interface, it's a very complex interface. Now, of course, this is the result, even though it's an N of one, this is the result of visiting a whole bunch of bifurcations. And then all those bifurcations, each one of which has a small amount of kinematic irreversibility, you now put that all back up into the main trachea, and you can see something that looks like this.
Then
please.
In what sense is it reasonable to assume that the geometry is really reversible? Because, you know, everything's moving around.
And I know we tried to build this, or we have built this experiment with the cylinders, and it's very important to have good bearings. And if there's a bit wobble in the bearings, then
it doesn't work.
Right away.
Then it doesn't work,
so,
right?
So I can imagine on the smallest things, it's the alveoli and that kind of, good. Wrong.
Well, that's a beautiful point because, as I say, if you actually do the measurements of dots on the pleural surface, it's awfully close to being reversible. But 1%, 2%, 5%, at each one of these bifurcations is sufficient to wreck that whole, that entire idea. So you're absolutely right. And I think it really was a hair in Taylor's cylinder, and it's a bad bearing in the one that you made, and it just doesn't work. Because you have to be really, really, really careful about what you mean by reversibility. It's one of those cases that, you know, the limit of 0 plus and 0, this may not be a continuous function of all the way down to 0 irreversibility. But yes, you're absolutely right.
Typical example of a chaotic system. So you
hold that thought. I think this is not chaotic. Okay? But that's something that I want to ask you folks about because you know more about fluid mechanics than I do. I think it's not chaotic. Well, mostly I don't know what it is. Here's a longitudinal section, and you can see that not only is it all mixed up on this cross section, but it's also striated this way at the same time. So these are the same kinds of striations that you saw. Notice it's not swirly this way. So this really is a kind of axial phenomenon. You don't see the same kind of patterns that look like this on this section that is coincident with the axis of the bronchus. And there's just a couple more pictures. Okay, so how can we analyze this? So I'm now going to try to do a problem which I thought at the beginning was going to be a really easy problem. I like easy problems. But this turned out to be much, much more difficult than I had realized. And I still don't understand the implications of it completely by any means. The concept itself is going to sound a little bit silly. I want to do fluid mechanics in one dimension. Tomorrow we're going to hear about turbulence in two dimensions. Three dimensions is, I have no idea what happens in 3D. I thought that 1D would be easy. Now, what do I mean by fluid dynamics in one dimension? Well, what I mean is this. I'm also going to simplify the problem to a single bifurcation. Which, what could be simpler than this? And I'm going to completely ignore anything in this radial direction. Everything is going to be one-dimensional in the parent branch, one-dimensional in the right branch, one-dimensional in the left branch. This is really as simple as I can imagine getting. So here's a velocity profile. I'm going to take it to be sinusoidal. There's a sinusoidal velocity profile in the right branch and in the left branch. And by volume conservation, these things happen to have, you can either think of it as velocity with uniform area, or you can think of U as a volume velocity. So this is just a statement of conservation of mass. And what I want to do is to say, this is sinusoidal, this is sinusoidal, this is sinusoidal, but this is a little bit asynchronous with its sibling. Okay? So this is what it looks like. This is for 20 degrees. As far as I know, the measurements that we made now some 20 years ago are the only measurements ever made of geometric hysteresis in a lung. And we found that under normal conditions in the rabbit, the level of asynchrony was on the order of 10 degrees. I'm showing here 20 degrees, just so that the graphs don't get all smushed together. So here's the volume velocity in the parent branch. It's just sine t. And here's the volume velocity in the right branch, the right daughter and the left daughter, with a phase lag of alpha. And you can see that it's the left branch is leading the right branch, because the left branch is already inspiring relative to the right branch. Volume flows are taking inspiratory in the sense of a bifurcating tree. Inspiratory is positive, expiratory is negative. So that's the picture. And I thought this, I thought this was going to be about, half a day to figure out what happens if you put in a bolus. And there's, oh, I want to emphasize, I'm putting in no diffusion at all. There's no diffusion. So this is strictly kinematics. And because it's strictly kinematics, I could say, okay, I'm going to put a bolus, a delta function, somewhere, and I'm just going to track what happens as it evolves in time. And these are sine waves, for heaven's sake. I mean, what could be? Now, here's what happens. I made some labels. I didn't label the graph as well as I should have. All right, so I'm going to start. Oh, my coordinate system goes from goes from left to right if I were to draw it. If I were to draw it like this. This is the point x equals minus 2. The origin is at 0. And these are both plus, plus. So this is the left branch, right branch, and parent branch. I picked minus 2 because the magnitude of the tidal variation of sine has got a magnitude of 2. So you either have to have a 2 there or you have to put a half sine t if you wanted to make it 1. That's why it's minus 2. So I said, all right, I'll just put a bolus, a little delta function for a particle, a delta function of concentration, at minus 1 or minus 1.1. And what happens? Well, at time 0, you start breathing in. Remember, at time 0 is when the parent branch is starting to inspire. The left branch is already inspiring, and the right branch is expiring at that time. But there's no effect on the parent branch. Parent branch starts to inspire. And as it starts to inspire, that bolus of stuff just marches down that parent branch towards the bifurcation. Okay, and it hits the bifurcation, or in better language, it visits the origin of the coordinate system. It visits the origin and then splits. Part of it goes into the left branch, part of it goes into the right branch. The fractionation of how much goes into left and how much goes into right is volume velocity weighted. So if it's going in, if there's twice as much going into this branch as this branch, then what we say is that the magnitude, the delta function that goes here and here, this is 1/3 delta of x minus ut, and this is 2/3. So it's the volume velocity weighted fractionation. So now I've got two pieces, one in the right branch and one in the left branch. And then after some amount of time, they come back to visit the origin. And after it visits the origin, it goes back into the parent branch. And this guy goes back into the parent branch. So that makes sense, and that's not particularly surprising. But now some other interesting things happen. So this guy comes back in. And again, it splits into a left-right branch. This fellow splits into a left-right branch. But I think you can see, before we even think about this little fellow, I think you can see what's going to happen here. It's like the exponentiation of the phyllo dome, that every time you visit the origin, you get two more for the one that you bring in at the beginning. That's not quite true, because sometimes you have coincidence that the return to the origin for this fellow and the return to the origin here actually happens at exactly the same time. So it's not really it's not really 2 to the nth. So what's going on is something that looks like this. I tried practicing this, but I can't really do it. So instead of going like this, it's like asking people to do, to demonstrate phase lengths. So I have something that's going like this. And this one itself splits into these two, followed by this one that's coming down, and it splits into two. But it's not even like this. It's one's like this and one's like this because they're going at different volume velocities. This one is interesting because there are trajectories where you come from the parent, you go into the left branch, and you come back, and as you're coming back, it turns out that the right branch is inspiring. So instead of going back out the parent, you actually turn the corner and start to inspire on the right branch. That's called Pendelluft for the physiologists here. And then you come back out. And that one's interesting because that means that if I would have my hand, if I just visited the left branch, from your point of view, if I just visited the left branch and came back out, I would do something like this. But if I also visited the right branch before coming back out, I would do this. That means that the Jacobian is minus one. And that means that whatever we're going to compute from this thing with respect to stretching and folding, and this is one dimensional, the fact that there's a Jacobian of minus one is that whatever we're doing is an underestimate of the amount of stretching and folding. Because the only way you can actually go from here to here to here is to now induce a rotation in the real fluid. Okay? So the existence of these extra pieces that have these funny Jacobians of minus one, and of course, so even at the end of two cycles, it's getting a little bit complicated. And by the time you get to three cycles and at the end of four cycles or in the middle of four cycles, I've got a whole mess of stuff in there.
You assume the phase lag between the two sides to be constant.
Yes. One is, it's sine t, and it's sine t plus 20 degrees and sine t minus 20 degrees.
It might fluctuate though in real life, right?
Oh, to be sure. Yes, of course. Which makes it even worse. Okay, so how can we display this? Besides a drawing that looks like this, which is the evolution of the trajectories in time, I can do what I think is called a logistic map. I don't know why it's called logistic. Maybe somebody here knows. Here's a logistic map. And it's a map of the function that takes you from some initial position. So here's an initial position from minus 2 to 0 to plus 1. Minus 2 to 0 is the axis for the initial bolus at time 0. If it were in the parent, it would be somewhere along this from here to here. If it was in the left or right branch, it would be somewhere along here. That's the abscissa. The ordinate is where that bolus goes after exactly one cycle. So this is the example I had in the previous slide. I start at minus one, and after one cycle, I got two blobs, one here and one here. And that's shown as the two blobs, one's here and one's here. Okay, that's pretty straightforward. But now after two cycles, whoops. So after two cycles, after the first cycle, I've got a source here and a source here. But to make this on the ordinate a source, I just walk over to the line of identity and say that this is the new source. And similarly, I walk over to the line of identity and this is the new source. So this guy breaks into three pieces. There's one, two, three. And this guy breaks into three pieces. Okay. And then now I can repeat that. And if I repeat that, I'll come back at this point. Here's after four cycles. And it's now getting sufficiently complicated that I can't even, I mean, it's hard for me to trace these things. One interesting point that I'll come back to in a minute is that you might wonder whether or not whether these trajectories form closed orbits or not. And that's one of the issues of, you know, dynamical systems trying to characterize whether or not or under what circumstances one has closed orbits versus non-closed orbits. And it also relates to the issue of whether there is or is not chaos. But you can see that it's getting, at least in this example, it's getting to be a mess. And here it's displayed. All three of those are displayed here. And this is the graph that I just put on the graph on the blackboard of the convective length scale decaying roughly geometrically or exponentially, and the diffusive length scale increasing like square root time.
How many cycles did you have to do the experiments to get those patterns?
To get which?
To get the flow patterns you were showing originally?
Oh, the flow patterns that you saw originally, that was one cycle. But it was one cycle, but that cycle had sampled probably 12 or 14 bifurcations on the way down and on the way back. So how many cycles? I don't know. You can either count that as one, or you can count it as 14. I mean, that's sort of a difficult question, because we have done experiments in model systems made out of plastic and verified all of this stuff. That in plastic, where you can actually control things, you know, you got a pipe this big, you can see it, you can take pictures of it. The lung is harder because, you know, there's all these serially disposed bifurcations. It's a much more complicated system as it goes down this bifurcating tree. All right. What are the characteristics that we find? Okay, so what we find is there is this splitting of the bolus. Every cycle has a splitting into at least one, I mean, into at least two, if not three, separate pieces. And this really is just purely kinematic. There's no diffusion going on. So part two here is the first really hard statement that has hard mathematics in it. What that means is that for almost all, and I say that advisedly, for almost all phase angles, no matter where you start with the original bolus, asymptotically you will visit almost everywhere. So what's the almost?
Ergodicity?
It's very close to ergodicity. But it's also the thing that the mathematicians love, which is whether it really is everywhere or almost everywhere. And the answer to that question is that if the phase angle alpha is a rational multiple of pi, then the orbits are closed. You have closed orbits. But the set of numbers which are rational multiples of pi is a set of measure zero. And so we can say that for almost all phase angles, there are no closed orbits. And moreover, the visiting where you visit is dense. It doesn't say you can get everywhere, but it says you can get arbitrarily close. You know, you give me an epsilon, and I'll find an n such that after n cycles, my bolus, there will be a non-zero piece of my bolus at this, you know, within epsilon of where you specify. So it's dense, and it's true for almost all. That's the two pieces of the hard math part of this story. That the final asymptotic distributions are dense, and that statement is true for almost all phase angles. That's part two. Now, part three is what I find stunning. And I have absolutely no intuition about why this should be true. The fact that it ends up, that where you end up going, if you're an irrational multiple of pi, if you're an irrational multiple of pi, I mean, it's the same thing as saying, you know, pick an irrational number between 0 and 1, and then just double it and take it mod 1. Well, yeah, I mean, just keep doing that, and pretty soon you're going to fill up the space between 0 and 1. I mean, that's, you know, there's a pigeonhole principle, you know, in number theory that tells you how to do that. But the fact is that the final distribution, not only is it dense, but it's uniform, as if it were diffusing. And there's no diffusion here. There's no way that the bolus here knows anything about what its neighbor is doing in the sense of a gradient or a Laplacian or anything else that would tend to make this guy want to look like its neighbor. Its two nearest neighbors. I mean, that's what makes diffusion end up being uniform, is that you want to be like your neighbor. You know, your two neighbors are down, so you squat down. Your two neighbors are higher, you get it. But there's no link at all, because it's just pure kinematics. It's pure kinematics. There's no diffusion. It's one dimension. There's no reason on Earth. Well, there is a reason. I just don't know the reason why this asymptotic distribution should turn out to be uniform. I thought about it a lot, and I don't even have epsilon on this. I have zero intuition why it should come back uniform. And if anybody's got any bright ideas or any ideas about why that should be true, let me know. So a couple more comments. This is kind of a self-advertisement. It's a new thing, you know. Point five, is this chaotic? I don't know very much about chaos. I think it's not. And let me say why. When we first started wondering why it is that you could have these particles that are not supposed, they're just basically not diffusing very much, how they could end up depositing in the lung, we thought of two mechanisms. One of which was that because of the peculiar geometry, particularly in the pulmonary acinus, where you've got fluid flow past salient edges, and past salient edges, now you've got some flow separation. And if you can find, or if there's a flow regime where there's a saddle point, then you can say, ooh, a saddle point. That's interesting, because a saddle point would mean that if I'm coming in with two particles that are arbitrarily close, then I hit the saddle point, and now all of a sudden those two points go like this, and I can have exponential divergence of separation between two points, sometimes called sensitivity to initial conditions. And so the existence of saddle points by itself is a potential mechanism that could contribute to the deposition of fine and ultrafine particles. And we think that's also true. But I think that's true chaos, in the sense that there really is a sensitivity to initial conditions. This is not chaos. Again, I'm not a chaos expert, but at least in my sense, it's not chaotic in the sense that if I have two boluses that are close together, and I look at what happens to those two boluses after one cycle, they're still close together. They're not exponentially diverging from one another.
What's the problem here? After one cycle.
Oh, because the map is continuous. The reason the thing. Yeah.
That's what you mean by.
But that's happening, I don't think, at the level of. That's not happening at the level of the final position of these two boluses in the same. If they come back, if this original pair comes back as two pairs like that, these are still close together. But I think what's happening, and this might be chaos, is that what's really driving the system is not this distance, which is perfectly continuous, but this distance. It's the phase lag that's giving you a non-zero difference on each cycle. So maybe that is chaos.
The end argument you have is somehow saying that this is the same thing, because basically the stretching and folding story gives you how the trajectories of two arbitrary close initial points will evolve.
Okay,
after you
fair enough.
The end cycle.
Yeah, okay. If it is, I guess it depends on one's definition. I'm sorry?
Small. I think you're saying the Lyapunov exponent is small, but it's not.
Okay, fair enough. I guess I was only, all right. I should back off on this, as I say, I'm not a chaos guy. Is only to make the distinction between this kind of mechanism and saddle point mechanisms, which at least visually to me are very different. And I've heard of Lyapunov. I have no idea how to calculate one.
Have you heard of this so-called microfluidic mixer, so-called herringbone mixer, which is actually developed in Harvard about 10 years ago? And it has exactly the same structure. It has basically a herringbone design that can go through a cycle and basically stretch and fold and stretch and fold.
Ooh,
right. Viscous fluid, which will eventually mix it. So it's used for mixing small volumes of fluid
within
Taylor's regime. And there are people who do so-called chaotic mixing, which is exactly, again, this kind of thing. There are, you know, hundreds of pages of literature on this. Even mathematicians work on this.
Wonderful. Okay. So it's in part rediscovering the wheel, although we did this 10 years ago. But anyway, okay, yeah, other comments or questions? I've only got a couple more comments to make.
The uniformity aspect is sort of reminiscent of implications of Liouville's theorem, too. I mean, I think there really is an analogy with...
Which Liouville's theorem?
Liouville's theorem. You know, about...
you mean the thermodynamic?
I mean, you can take Taylor's thing and you can think of it as an interesting example.
You mean uniformity? If you wait long enough, you're going to visit everywhere uniformly in phase space.
Accessible points of phase.
Oh yeah, this argument, of course, stops at the edge, at the boundary of the kinematically accessible region. But if it's accessible, yeah, Liouville.
So
oh, that's a good point.
Is it just saying that once you reach some steady state, a uniform distribution satisfies steady state plus the analog of Liouville's theorem?
Yes.
Like a microcanonic, like...
Yeah, it's easy enough it's almost trivial to show that the uniform distribution satisfies, you know, all the kinematic conditions after one cycle. The hard part is to show that distribution exists as a limiting distribution and that it's unique. My mathematician friends tell me that that's the really hard part. You have to use contraction
mathematics. Ask Boltzmann. I mean.
Well, yeah. It's like the Boltzmann-H theorem, right? Okay, good.
So here's a kind of self-confession about using computers.
So we wrote some programs to try to figure this stuff out. And we kept getting back into closed orbits. And then I thought, well, wait a minute. All the stuff that we do on computers is really done in rational arithmetic. And so it raised the question of how long do you have to go before you before you get close to one of these asymptotic distributions? Do I have to do 5 cycles? Do I have to do 50 cycles? And that depends on how close is alpha to a rational number. And the first time I even had that thought, I said, what, come on. I mean, the rationals are dense, the irrationals are dense, everybody's dense. It doesn't make any sense to talk about how close you are to a rational number. But of course, there's a subdiscipline within number theory that says, you know, here's a number, how close is it to a rational number? And if you're very close to a rational number, you got to have a lot of turns of the crank before that thing finally starts breaking out. And once it breaks out, then you get to the asymptotic distribution. But it means that it was hard for me, to really trust the computer stuff that I was doing. Because I just didn't know whether I was close, I was far. You know, the whole idea, even in computerese, of knowing when I'm close to a rational number or not was hard for me to figure out. So it was just kind of a caveat on using computer stuff. So back to the... So if you take off the math or the physics hat and go back to biology, there's... that's a technical detail. So here's a couple of open questions. Does it matter if you breathe quietly? Does it matter if you breathe a lot? Rest versus exercise? How do we think about the implications for whether or not children should be kept indoors in Los Angeles when there's an ozone alert or a smog alert? Should you systematically avoid exercise or not? Or is that is that importantly bad for you to exercise? Probably the more interesting one is the developing one, because there's a number of structural differences. It doesn't look like the decorated alveolar duct with decorated, you know, alveoli going around it. It's a, as I said yesterday, it's a more saccular structure. There's much less potential for saddle points in the newborn lung. So in some sense, the newborn lung is protected against the kind of deposition that's associated with fine and ultrafine. And we found that using morphometry as a function of age, that this is actually an important question, because you know, the EPA standards for what we're allowed to breathe, or how much garbage the, you know, the diesel engines and the whatnot are allowed to put into the atmosphere, are all based on adults. And we thought it was important to know whether or not that's true for children or not. If children are more at risk, we should know about that. If children are less at risk, we should know about that. What we discovered was really quite fascinating. We don't have hard experimental evidence for this, but if anything that I've been saying today and what we've done in our saddle point theories is true, when you connect it to the structural pieces, it looks like newborns are less at risk. But between human age 2 or 3 and 7 or 8, they're more at risk. So it's like the risk goes like this, if this is the adult risk. So there's a window where the newborn babies are protected. But there's a window, you know, when the kids are really, really exercising, they're running around outside, you know, climbing trees and doing that kind of stuff, where they're more at risk for deposition. So we're trying to get the EPA interested in actually looking at this, because if that's true, then either standards or the triggering thresholds when you have to keep kids home from school might be different. So the newborns is one. Adolescent, obviously, that's the question here, between the newborns, which look to be, as I say, probably less at risk, the adolescents are more at risk in comparison with the adult. So finally, and this is the last slide. So the final set of questions would be, you know, we've argued this on the basis of some physics, some one-dimensional fluid dynamics, and some experiments in rat lungs. Is it really important in human lungs? And is it important, and if so, for what particle size range? I've just argued that it's important for the fine and ultrafine, but we don't really know that. How do we extrapolate from animals to humans? The structures are similar, but they're not the same. And one question, I mean, you were asking was whether it happens after one breath or you got to take 10 breaths for this to happen. We don't really know. In fact, the picture that you, my self-portrait that you saw yesterday of me hanging in zero gravity was part of an experiment to actually probe this exact question that the folks at UCSD were doing a study on particle transport. And they wanted to do it in the absence of the confounding factor of gravitational sedimentation. And the way to do that is to do it up in space, where you do it in the, you know, in the parabolic flights of the KC-135. So they asked me to come along, or I asked them if I could come along, and look at this exact question after one breath, or after one breath and then a couple of in and outs to try to push the stretch and fold. And we got some ambiguous results. Is bolus spreading the most appropriate measure for mixing? I don't know the answer to that. It's what everybody uses. You breathe in a bolus of some kind of particles, and you have a photometer at the airway opening. You breathe it in, you get a spike like this. Breathe it in, and you breathe it out, and you get another big blob. And one takes the width at half height, or some kind of measure of the dispersion of that bolus, as the metric of mixing. I say the, because nobody does anything else. And I'm perfectly happy to think about dispersion of a bolus. I don't know if it's the only
metric, and I don't know if it's the most appropriate metric, but it is what everybody uses. But I think it's worth thinking about. And obviously there's implications for inhalation and deposition of pathogens on the bad side, and the targeted delivery of drugs aerosolized on the good side. So with that I'll stop. Thank you very much. Questions, arguments?
You said you did experiments with plastic tubes.
Yeah.
So you said something about the difference you found between those experiments and the experiments you when you have to do on the lungs.
Yes and no. The experiment that we did in plastic was, in effect, the same experiment. It's a Taylor experiment, but instead of an annular thing where you could just, you turn the crank, we had pistons and we put in a little drop of dye, and we could watch the dye as the dye evolved and either came back or didn't come back, or it came back folded. If you did one of these kinds of things, if it was, if it was some asynchrony, it might be that, which fit all of the stuff that I'm describing here. So the in plastic experiments that we did, and all of this little one-dimensional stuff that I'm describing, there's an exact one-to-one match with that. The link between that and what you can see in a lung is tough, because lungs are not simple one parent tube with two daughter branches. And
it's plastic is there some elastic constants that there.
No, plastic ridges, I mean.
So there's some elastic, you have elastic tube, you have a finite, which is in the time of your cycle, so the Reynolds numbers are going to be zero, there's going to be some.
The Reynolds numbers that we used were all much, much less than one. Mm-hmm. 0.01, 0.001. I do appreciate that there may be a difference in some circumstances where there's flow separation, that a Reynolds number of zero plus and a Reynolds number of zero might be different. I appreciate that. But I think in this context, everything that we have is just essentially Stokes flow. The pressures that we use are essentially zero. So whatever the elastic properties of the tubes are, there's negligible dilation or contraction of the tubes. These are stiff. It's a piece of plastic. And if the pressures are on the order of magnitude of a tenth of a centimeter of water pressure, there's not going to be any dimensional change. I don't think in the geometry. It's not that I don't think there is. There is negligible change in the geometry, given the pressures that we're using.
But I guess the fluid flow, though, how the you have there is some fluid flow, and I.
Oh yeah. But I think at this level of what we're doing, the fluid's water or oil, and that's again, it's essentially incompressible. It's just incompressible fluid flow.
Nevertheless, the tube coming up through the tube, so I go to that and I get some sort of stagnation point or something.
That's true. Absolutely.
And then and it's well known fact to mechanics that the Stokes approximation breaks down.
Fair enough. Yep. Okay, that's a good point. That does not happen in my one-dimensional stick figure, right? In one dimension, I don't have a stagnation point.
Oh, okay.
But in the experiments, yes. As long as we put our little dye tracer in the middle of the tube, it didn't sample that bottom stagnation point, and it would go down and it would do all the right stuff. If we do a sufficient number of cycles that now there's enough lateral kinematic motion that it does see that stagnation point, then you're right. And then we see all kinds of crazy stuff happen. So the plastic model, in some respects, is a very good mimic of this, as long as we stay away from those stagnation points. But your point is well taken.
Okay.
That's a perfectly good point. And that's where it would break down.
And this point affects the flow around it. So
absolutely.
Even if you don't go through that point, it does affect.
Yes, it will. Yes, it will. Yeah, right. No, but you're right. And it's certainly a part of what happens in the lung, because as I said, you know, if you have enough inertial impaction, you can actually see, you know, you take out a lung, and you look, and it's right at that stagnation point that you see all this deposition of junk. So that is an important part of the localization of the site of deposition, both of pathogens and of tracers and everything else. Indeed, it may be the case that dominates over everything I've said here. I mean, these are all candidates. And I guess my sense is that, you know, you have a bunch of candidates and there will be a regime of flow or particle size or tube size or velocity or Reynolds number or Peclet number or something. There's a regime where mechanism A is the dominant mechanism. And there may be a, you know, regime two with a different this and a different that where mechanism B. And there may, of course, then be this intermediate regime where everything is contributing at the same time. But how to differentiate those different regimes, we don't know.
Yeah? I guess on the plastic models, how did you impose the phase shift? By boundary conditions at the ends of the tubes, or?
We had two pumps.
I see. Then you just pump them differently.
And you pump them.
With the phase shift.
If I can do this right.
Yeah, okay.
There we go.
So if you
there's a pi over four.
Okay. If you were to put a constriction on a single tube, you might get something similar, right? Like an out of phase constricting change in geometry. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure, that's possible.
So the heartbeat, you know, is out of phase with the breathing or whatever. Then
oh, yes, we've not tried to put in the heart at all. That's.
Sure.
Yep, that would certainly affect it. There's also tonic activity in airway smooth muscle, which itself has its own characteristic times. It can constrict, it relaxes, it constricts, it relaxes, and now you've got another degree of freedom for the introduction of yet more asymmetry, or asynchrony.
I guess the ones that happen at the very end, close to the alveoli, would be the ones that have the most influence on what happens on the way back, right?
Yes.
So, stuff, dynamic stuff happens at the very end, it would be mixed.
Correct.
Very efficiently.
Yes. Good. Other questions? I have to go back. I have to change my definition or my notion of chaos. I guess I'm using the word incorrectly. But thank you all.
Thank you.